It's so exciting to be back and now diving into these concepts. So I'm so thrilled to discuss agency today. That's something that you and I, Jen, have gone back and forth on so much. And it's a really hot topic right now. But something that bothers me about many of these conversations that I hear surrounding agency is that it's often conflated with other concepts that lead us to explore agency really minimalistically. We rarely see discussion of the benefits of agency alongside our overarching goals as trainers, as behavior consultants, as pet guardians, in the sense of it not only being an act of kindness, but there is a great degree of literature demonstrating that agency is a potent force behind efficient and positive and lasting behavioral change. And so just focusing on these sort of myopic pieces of agency, I feel like doesn't give the broader pet industry, as well as pet owners, a sense of the value of agency and why we should be talking about it more and incorporating it more into our lives.
I totally agree. As I have been looking for various scientific articles about agency and about these concepts as we know them in humans, I've been searching and searching and searching for things in the dog world. And every time I get excited and I come across something that has agency in the title or it comes up in a podcast and my ears perk up, it always, so far in my experience, has turned out to really just be about choice. And while choice is important and great, and we should be offering our animals choices, agency is so much broader than that, and I'm really excited to dig into the differences. It's probably helpful, actually, if we start there with what the differences are in terms of agency and some of the other concepts that kind of accompany it in our conversations. Where should we start?
Great question. Probably with some common definitions, because I think in conversations I've had with fellow colleagues or other people who share this interest, there is sort of, I think, such a broad vagueness to agency that we all are operating from different understandings about maybe what that core element of it is and how these other pieces of choice are related, but maybe not synonymous with agency. And so I really like to centralize from the definition that Albert Bandura gives, and it's very similar to another definition that I like from Gallagher, who I will put in the comments. But this one is really comprehensive. So it is an individual's belief. That is a really important piece. It is a belief in their ability to exercise control over their own independent functioning and external environment. And so it isn't always the outcome that matters, but it's the impact intrinsically that leads to agency. And that is a missing piece very often in our exercising of giving choice, of giving other pieces that we think are adjacent to agency, is really centering it around cultivating that belief. And so, as such, I view agency as an antecedent. It needs to be a prerequisite for any environment in which we're seeking behavioral change. And in that, looking for some of those maybe indicators that agency is present, which Bandura goes on to define. And I know you've read this as well. Jen, do you want to speak a little on that?
Sure. So when we're looking at agency, kind of the four core functions of agency would be intentionality, forethought, self-reactiveness, and self-reflectiveness. All of which really lead me to thinking about the idea of influence, and how we in our environments act in different ways, think in different ways that influence both our behavior and the behavior of those around us. And Bandura notes that these move us toward self-regulation of motivation, affect, and action, and taking self-directed action, which in an animal with behavioral issues, those are exactly the goals that we're going for. Self-regulation, taking self-directed action in terms of away from a trigger or whatever the animal needs to do to make themselves feel better in that moment, and giving them the opportunity to influence how that happens. Those are kind of my thoughts around those four core functions.
Absolutely. And I love that Bandura actually takes it further to define multiple ways in which we enact agency, or I should say multiple levels at which we enact agency, because they're not exactly the ways in which we do that. And the first is individual, which I think is the most relatable to our human experience, right? The ways that we can decide for ourselves that we want something from the refrigerator and go and get it. And we're able to be effective in enacting and finding things that are of value to us. And we'll circle back to values later. The second is proxy agency. And this is the one that I feel is most relevant to our animal experience, especially our domestic animal experience. that is the ability to basically recruit someone or another being who has the resources to act in the interest that you're trying to achieve in order to work with you toward that goal. So you're still able to get the outcomes that you want, but you're not able to do so directly and independently, but it still contributes to that belief of having agency. And so in our dog's experience, for example, their world exists around them, built for humans by humans. And so they have to have some better ability to utilize humans to access the things that they need. And I think it's something that we don't focus quite enough on in how we are enacting agency. And that it also in some ways is differentiated from individual agency, and that I think so many of us conflate agency with freedom. Right? You're just giving them the freedom to go be off leash and do whatever they want. And that's not the same thing either. We're not talking about letting dogs run the world or do things that are unsafe just because they're getting that belief that they have the ability to control some of their circumstances. That leads to more confidence, that leads to more empowerment. And so that proxy agency piece, I think, is a very good stepping stone for us of giving animals more agency without having that worry of more freedom leading to possible negative effects. And that's something we can definitely dive more into. And then the last one is collective agency, which is a lot more about how we, you know, utilize our organizations of groups and a larger community scale version of agency, which and certainly, I'm sure, relevant, but maybe not as much to this discussion.
Yes. Who knows? Maybe in the future, but not as far as we can see right now. Yeah. Going back to the idea of proxy agency, I agree with you that that's like the kind of the foundational element here in terms of thinking about how we empower dogs. And I wanted to note that how that's different from giving choice. So in giving choice, I might present a dog with two different treats and they might choose which one interests them more at that moment. When we're really giving proxy agency, we're teaching them to communicate more broadly. So it's not limited to one specific context, or it's not just between two choices. This morning, Chloe was driving me crazy, needed something. I couldn't figure out what it was, got up and stood next to her. She directed me to a toy. She was driving me crazy again, got up and directed me somewhere else. So she has a framework that she can use to get me to do what she wants across context, whether that is choosing between toys and food or whatever it is. It's a little bit broader than how we usually think about just choice.
Absolutely. And in that, we get veto power. So when we're thinking about how we offer choices to animals, there is a missing piece in what really cultivates agency. And agency is involved in this idea of accessing things that are valuable to us. That's what, you know, that impactful piece of controlling and having some ability to alter our circumstances. We're doing so because it works towards something that we value, some outcome that we value about that experience. Just being able to change things in general doesn't always help us to feel that we have agency. And so we really want to go back to kind of also defining values as playing a role in this. And I think in many ways that gets obscure for many people, but there is a centralized definition when we're talking about the science of behavior analysis. So values, according to Wilson and Dufresne, 2009, again, we'll cite these sources in the caption. Values are, quote, freely chosen consequences of ongoing, dynamic, evolving patterns of activity, which establish predominant reinforcers for that activity that are intrinsic in engagement in the valued pattern itself. And so in simpler terms, values have a crucial role in establishing the most important reinforcers for that individual. And cultivating agency involves contact with values-aligned functional reinforcement. And we can, in many circumstances, be given a choice that does not provide an opportunity to align with our values, that may even oppose our values. So for example, if we have a reactive dog and our choices are you can move closer to the left or closer to the right, but really the valued outcome is to move away, we might still see them making a choice. But is that choice reinforcing a belief that they can act in an agentic fashion that leads to empowerment? And that's where we start to tease apart choice from agency. And I believe that it still plays a crucial role, that we need to be able to have choice. But that brings us to a whole other issue, which is how we present choice and what choice actually means. Is it that we're saying, now we've opened a door for you, dog, and you can choose between door A or door B? And that may limit in many ways agency. For a dog that has none, that is still a stepping stone towards agency. It's really a spectrum for sure. But is that really what we're trying to achieve? We're trying to achieve this dog that is able to self-regulate, to utilize forethought and self-reactiveness towards self-efficacy. I think that the missing piece is being able to cultivate dogs that are able to act on that belief without us opening the door to those opportunities. And that's a different type of choice. This is teaching that choices are available to you when I have not offered them, and that you can express what that choice may be that is aligned with your values, so that maybe in offering choices, if we have not offered one that they want, they're able to show us that option as well. And in that, give us so much more insight to resources that we can use towards behavior modification in unparalleled ways.
And in offering them the opportunity to make this vast array, these vast array of choices, we also keep ourselves from accidentally inhibiting their choices. So the ways that we control dogs that we don't even think about, never realize until they have the opportunity to tell us otherwise, I think that we as humans have a really difficult time conceptualizing of that. And maybe that's why choice feels good to us. And choice is good. It is a step in the right direction. But when we think about if somebody is presenting me with two options, I as a human know that later on in the day, if I don't like those two options, I can go do the thing I do want to do. I maybe have chosen to be in the presence of this person that is offering me these two choices. There are so many things that we as humans have in terms of our agency that we just take for granted that dogs don't have, that we are overriding all of the time just by the nature of the human-dog relationship. So it is opening doors for them is important and it's great, but going a step beyond that to let them express what they want to be behind the doors. Do they want to open the door? Do they want to go in a different room? Do they want to lay down and take a nap? There could be a million other things that they're wanting to do or needing to do in that moment that we just would never know.
I think we get satisfied when we give a choice and they seem happy with that choice, which is fair when we think about it from their perspective, right? If they otherwise don't have the opportunity to ask for a treat, or maybe they can ask for a treat, but not what kind. And we start opening the door to now you can give me a preference. I can open the bag of chicken or the bag of beef and you get to pick between these two. And now I'm really catering to some of your preferences. That is a big step, certainly. But there's also a missing piece when we start to acknowledge the potential for cognitive capabilities that we observe in our dogs all the time, but that maybe we don't emphasize enough in training and learning, that we emphasize a lot more in the way that we treat humans and the way that we interact with humans and human behavior. And that is this idea that animals are anticipating patterns, that they're capable of forethought, which we know when they learn from learning histories and start adapting those histories to new situations, we have some evidence of that. We don't have maybe the evidence of the exact scope to which we are giving credit to animals for these things. And in doing so, I think that limits the ways that we are enacting our attempts to increase agency. So what I mean by that is, for example, we know that humans have the ability to operate under rule governance, which sounds complicated, but the idea being that we not only experience rules from our interactions with others in our society, but that we also set rules for ourselves. And that can come from just, you know, doing things repetitively or having interactions with other people and learning when I do this, it leads to this outcome. And therefore I won't do this anymore because I like this certain behavior from that other person. And so there's this social kind of cognitive aspect. We know that dogs really enjoy engaging with us, but when we start engaging with them in routine ways, for example, a reactive dog that we take on the same route every single day, do they start to develop a rule for themselves that we've not directly taught them? We haven't directly said, we always go left here, but we've done it day after day. In that, do we also obscure choices that could lead to agency? If they learn, my only option is left because I've never tried right, and I won't ever try right because the only option is left, then how many ways are we stepping on their ability to potentially utilize their agency and develop their ability to believe that they can influence a world that we have built around them? It gets really daunting, but it can also become very understandable why so many domestic animals display behaviors that are, you know, driven by arousal and emotional issues and experiences of anxiety and frustration. Trying to navigate these sort of experiences would be incredibly frustrating and anxiety-inducing.
Absolutely. Like the kind of what must feel like an arbitrary nature of a leash. Sometimes you can go 2 feet, sometimes you can go 5 feet, and you never know when that wall is going to appear. Or there's an elevator in my building, and so we always get out and we go left in order to get to my apartment. What in the world lies on the right? And does it stress Chloe out? There are dogs that live on that half of the hallway. She knows that. She can smell them. She can hear them, but she's never been allowed to explore that. What does that do to increase her anxiety every time she gets out of the elevator, not knowing where they are, if they're coming toward her? Are they around the corner? Are they in the apartment? Just allowing dogs to explore all of their environment in ways that they determine they need, not that we decide they need, I think is really invaluable. And I definitely see it, as I've mentioned and just mentioned in Chloe.
Yeah. And it brings us sort of full circle back to that idea of proxy agency and how we're introducing it. If we're only teaching you, again, when we open these doors, then you're still kind of operating under rule governance. And so if that is a factor that you're experiencing, where you're deriving these rules that are inhibiting your own behavior, or contributing to frustration, or not giving us information that we could use to better serve you in these environments, if you want to get away and you don't think that's an option, we may, in assessing you through observation, assume that you want to get closer, because that's the only option that you've ever explored and the only option that you believe is available. And I think that's something that, as a behavior consultant, certainly for many years I did, where we put dogs in a situation and they don't know the alternatives. Therefore, we assume that the function is what we're seeing. And what we find time after time is when we offer more opportunities for self-generated communication and in combination with increasing agency, that we get better, clearer, more accurate information. And we see a pretty immediate dissolution of a lot of this arousal, which is a really interesting piece that we will certainly circle back to, because it does align with a lot of the literature in humans. There's one other thing that I'm trying to remember. It'll come back to me, I'm sure.
I was going to say that I agree with you, sort of bringing it back to the literature and the idea that this is how we approach dog training almost universally in terms of what I've seen, and the research in on the human side of things and how we learn and what benefits us in learning is so crystal clear in terms of the role of agency, the benefit of agency, and the backlash that other areas have experienced when they didn't include agency and sort of checks and balances in that way. And what people have now expressed that their experiences have been with those methods. We know that they can really backfire. They can really do a lot of damage to people. And since learning science can be considered kind of universal, we should really be thinking more about that in dogs.
Certainly we should. It's not just this goal of being kinder to our dogs and letting, you know, them explore things that are valuable to them, but doing that gives us a benefit. And the benefit is not a sacrifice. I think so often people hear these things and they think, oh, that means I'm giving my dog freedom. And that means that I have to open up a world to them that I then have to honor all of the time. And I am not equipped to do that. And therefore I can't do this. And therefore I'm not kind. And these are all things that we're kind of falsely equating. But really, when we're embracing agency, we don't have to give up control. We don't have to give up safety. We don't have to give up these things. We get more of those things through agency than we do without it. And I think that experience is something that's very difficult to describe until it has been lived.
I fully agree. It's difficult to describe, and I have lived it in my little N of one experience, and it's still difficult to describe. I think it's almost easier to think about as in our own experiences, looking back at things like education, if there's something that we were forced to participate in, versus something that we opted into, and the difference that made in our learning experience. And I had a more specific example, but I lost it.
When we have control over things, we know that the literature, even if it's a small modicum of control, says that it impacts the perception of an experience as aversive. So even if something has been historically aversive, having a modicum of this sense, this belief of agency, changes how we perceive those things and how we feel about them, even if nothing else changes, which is a really powerful and sort of untapped reservoir that we have when we're looking at behavior modification, which really revolves around emotional change. How are we utilizing that to the best of our ability? Thinking back to that dog who might be under some form of rule governance, or that idea that the leash is very arbitrary and how it pops up and it creates walls. Instead of viewing these things as confines to agency, which I think so often we do, we go, well, they have to be on leash. And that is true. We can acknowledge that piece is true. But does the leash part have to be arbitrary of when that pressure pops up? Could we use creative ways of offering choices, of offering communication, allow the dog to feel in control of when that leash tightens, where it goes, where they are attached to? So in many ways, to drive us rather than us using the leash as a tool to drive them, imparts agency, but maintains all of those pieces that are important to us. And I think that is a piece that is, it's complex. It's really hard for us to imagine because it really requires us to remove ourselves from our current experience and view it from various perspectives and different sides of the equation to find those pieces where we can give agency, where in the moments where those immediate abilities to act on choosing values, to act on freedoms, cannot be present, it allows that belief of agency to persist through them. And that is something that we know, it is long documented, that it is not a perfect honoring of every single thing that you've ever wanted in life. Certainly, we don't have that as humans and humans under our society, and we don't get to just do everything that we ever want. But yet we have this belief that we have agency. And so how do we cultivate and retain and make sure to nurture that while still recognizing the limitations of our experiences? But those are not mutually exclusive things. And they're things that are so often viewed as mutually exclusive.
Yes. Oh, that made me think so many things. Because when we step back to kind of the 30,000 foot view, humans, we ourselves do not live in a totally free society. We have laws, we have, you know, systems like democracy, capitalism, things that we live in that we may or may not have chosen. We might have changed countries, whatever, but we exist within a framework and we exist within various frameworks, and we don't freely choose everything all the time. And someone in our lives, multiple people, have taught us how to function within those frameworks and have taught us either verbally or through showing us demonstration, us learning the hard way. We've learned what the consequences are if we do things that either aren't accepted by society or break a law or, you know, break a social norm. And that takes me back to the earlier definition of agency and values-directed decision-making from Wilson and Dufresne, which was that values are freely chosen consequences. And so I think part of what is so helpful about the choice-based communication system specifically is that it teaches the dog what the consequences are in terms of, or like, what am I trying to say? Comes, or when, particularly when you start to bring in dress rehearsals and the idea that showing the impact of the dog's behavior out of context, that's what I'm looking for. So teaching them what happens out of context first, so they understand that if they act in a certain way, we will act in a certain way. If they look up, we will move forward. So then they know in the real world that if they look up at us, we are going to move forward toward that thing in the distance. And it empowers them to make an informed choice versus just kind of an arbitrary choice.
Yes, that is such an important piece, that why we take the time to utilize dress rehearsals as well in cultivating agency. Because I think another one of those barriers that we see is, well, my dog can't have control over that. They can't have control over their triggers. They can't tell me I want to go closer to the trigger. I'm not comfortable letting them go closer. All okay. Absolutely valid experiences. There is a piece of negotiating those together, but that doesn't mean that we have to do this in the real world to still impart the value of agency. We can do this in a controlled, safe environment with a stuffed dog and still get an experience that persists in that belief in the real world when we can't honor the choices. And it is really hard, I think, to grasp the impact of that until you've experienced it. But in doing so, when we cultivate agency and not just this idea that we have to honor every single choice and do so to perfection, because we don't do that in humans either. We know how to request things. We know how to request a raise or a Snickers in the aisle to our parents when we were kids. And we were told no a lot. But did that stop us from persisting and asking, for persisting and advocating for ourselves? No. And that is something that is a unique thing to balance that we can start to explore more. And something that I've seen in dogs is the resilience to not having choices honored, building exponentially under increased agency, and also the cooperation for outside input when that input aligns with the ultimate thing, that values piece, but may not be the exact choice that they wanted. So it could be that the animal expressed, I'd like to move away. And you said, no, we can't go that direction, but we can go this other direction. And in honoring the piece that was important about the choice, then we get a whole level of cooperation that still in not honoring the exact choice was able to reinforce that sense of agency. And these are little nuances that we're lacking when we break down choice into binaries or this sort of concrete offering of, you know, things that are not in the context of where these values might really be impactful.
Yeah. I mean, having them control their own access to, you know, thinking again in the context of a reactive dog, but control their own access to and movement around triggers is a much different concept than the idea of choosing between two treats or two toys. And you kind of mentioned the idea of them believing that they have control, or knowing that they have some aspect of control, even if they don't get the exact choice they want, which brings me to a paper, a really excellent paper. It's called A Theory of Momentary Distress Tolerance by Jennifer, I think it's Velu. Again, we can throw it in the notes or whatever. But what I love about this paper in particular is that in addition to having the author's own independent research, it does a really excellent job of covering a lot of the research that's been done to date on this exact idea of agency, and they call it self-efficacy, but the definitions overlap quite a bit, very similar to agency, but the effect of self-efficacy on distress tolerance. And there are at least six different studies that have established that that relationship is causal. It's not merely correlational, but actually that increased self-efficacy leads to increased stress tolerance. And so people have actually manipulated the variable of perceived self-efficacy, and that directly impacts their ability to choose to engage with stress, which then in humans directly impacts the outcome of therapy, basically, or of something like overcoming a fear. And so we know this really clearly in humans, and I can't get over the amount of research that exists about this and the lack of kind of incorporation of it into other realms.
Yeah, it is It's a big obstacle. And I think one of the big pieces of it that's missing is the sense of, you know, how can we communicate this with dogs or control for a sense of self-efficacy? How can we prove that you have that? And in many ways, we kind of can't, right? Like these are things that are, I joke about it being quantum behavior because we're observing the things around it that might indicate that, but we can't kind of prove that one little piece that exists because we can't directly observe it. There are sort of ways that we can measure and isolate pieces of variables, but we may never know that internal thought processes, the why, we're making guesses. But there is a great deal of documentation and a strategy around behavior analysis, which we utilize in dog training as a whole. That's, you know, all of our ABCs, our utilization of operant conditioning and looking at the elements and variables in a behavioral contingency and how they interrelate is that field of applied behavior analysis. And within that field, there's such a vast amount of knowledge and strategy for assessing values as well, even when those can't be directly communicated by the human and are often unreliably communicated by the human because they're influenced by variables like who's asking you and who your audience is and what's important to you at the time. And what we really have found is that when we look at patterns of choices and patterns of behavior, we can find these sort of variables that over or underlie these experiences and utilize those to our advantage. So it takes us beyond the scope of, I think, what we're comfortable talking about in animals because it is not yet proven. And I wholeheartedly will stand by the fact that I'm not a scientist, I'm not a researcher, but I do revere science, and I do believe that we should look at things from a perspective of what we do know. But I also recognize that there is harm in what we don't yet know, not that we've proven is not possible, and that is the cognitive capabilities of animals. And is there some potential of doing harm that we are doing by underestimating those abilities rather than assuming competence, which is a core tenet of human education, human therapy, human behavior modification, in which we assume that the learner has the capabilities to achieve what they want to achieve, but it is our role to make sure that they have the tools, the strategies, the resources to do that. And I think that is something that if we are assuming competence, we give all that we can. If it doesn't come together and we assume it is us and not them, we are better set up to continue to innovate along those lines to find those pieces so that eventually we can get the science to back it up. But the lack of science, the whole message of this right now is not a reason to toss out the value of agency when working with animals, but it is to say, how can we find ways to apply this where we might have some limitations, but are those limitations barriers that we cannot overcome? Because I don't think that they are.
Agreed. I think the same objection about not being able to see what's happening or not being able to know what's happening inside a dog's head, of course it exists in humans too. That's, you know, literally the name of the podcast, Beyond the Black Box. We can't know what's happening in the black box of our own minds. And as you mentioned, self-reports are notoriously unreliable. And so we look at behavior, and that research has been done in humans. I hope that it gets to be done in dogs. And I see no reason, as long as we're not doing harm, to sort of, you know, colloquially like throw the baby out with the bathwater here.
Totally agree. And then going back to that research on humans, there's so many things that could be immeasurably valuable to our work with animals. What you described of the sense of self-efficacy really being impactful, and how we can, if we are limited by their actual self-efficacy, modulate their perception of self-efficacy, which is something that I really love, but it requires that we acknowledge that there is a cognitive component to behavior. And we don't talk about that in behaviorism. We don't talk about that in dog training. We talk about the inputs and the outputs, the A's and the C's, and that inputs. And that's all that goes into it, really. We do talk about emotions, which is funny. We dip our toe in cognitivism, but not quite enough to kind of acknowledge the interplay between these things and that there is a great amount of science. There's a study that also really comes into play with this. It is titled Values Intervention as an Establishing Operation for Approach in the Presence of Aversive Stimuli. It was done in 2021 by Herbert A.L., and I'll put that citation under in the caption. And the idea of establishing operations, they are things that increase the value of a potential reinforcement. And in this case, it was something intrinsic. We don't know what the reinforcement was. It wasn't anything added, not money, not other things. But establishing operations are things that increase that value. So when we think about using food as reinforcement, hunger is an establishing operation. It increases that value versus when we're not as hungry, it's not as reinforcing potentially. And so the idea of values intervention, the quote from the abstract on that is, individuals were more likely to approach aversive situations if approach was related to a personal value versus a relatively arbitrary reward, for example, tickets, or without any specified consequence. Psychological inflexibility did not moderate the relationship between condition and approach. However, the values intervention condition did produce greater levels of approach than the control conditions. Previous studies have examined the impact of combined values and acceptance strategies, and the evidence from this study in particular suggests that values interventions alone may influence behavior. And I certainly believe that in what we've seen in what we've done with reactive dogs and sort of the influence of focusing on trying to find these patterns of values and cater to them in what we've seen the dogs engage with and the surprising things they tell us about their triggers is unbelievable. The ways in which they rapidly, without having to go through the time-consuming and methodical process of counter-conditioning, for example, within just learning how to tell us new things that we might not otherwise take from a situation. If we put a stuffed dog in the distance or we head outside for that first walk, their choices, I hate to use absolutes, but truly every single time has always surprised me and has done and has gone in a direction that we never anticipated, whether that's choosing not to go on a walk at all. They want to sit and watch for half an hour and didn't really want to go around the neighborhood in any direction is baffling. Or when around triggers, they want to move closer. And who would have ever thought? And they're showing us with intentionality, with continuous affirmation that that's what they're going for. And throughout the process of communicating their way past that trigger, doing so continuously and with such determination and focus on the task, it is really astounding. The things that just that ability to explore their agency around previously aversive experiences or things that we maybe assumed were aversive but weren't as much as we thought they were gives us unparalleled new information.
Yes, it does. And my little Miss Chloe. And I think the more time and effort that I put into learning about the functions of behavior, functional and natural reinforcers, the more I have come to view food or any extrinsic reinforcer, really anything that isn't actually relevant to what is underlying the dog's behavior, whether that is sitting or their reaction to a trigger, there's still value in them. It's not like throw them all out. That would be ridiculous, but it holds so much less value for the dog. And now I think for me, and it really can lead to a lot of coercion that we don't intend. Whether that is, you know, jumping through a hoop for a treat when a dog is injured, which I've personally seen. Or I've also seen, you know, we're in the vet and suddenly Chloe can hold it down when 10 minutes ago she was a wreck. And the only difference is that I brought out food. And I, at one point, would have been, oh, look, the training is working. She went into a down when I asked her. And instead I thought, wow, look how powerful food is. So I think anytime we're using extrinsic reinforcement, I now give a lot more thought to what it means that she complies with something for food versus something that I know is reinforcing what she has asked for herself, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, we know this could be a series of episodes on my feelings on food, which as a force-free and positive reinforcement trainer for a decade, I have used so much food. I am not against food, but there is a major difference between listening and telling and what the outcomes and end goals of that are. And food is our way of telling animals what to do, what to do in that moment, what to want in that moment. And in many ways, that has the power, just like you said, the extraordinary power to override our ability to listen to them. And so it's not that when using functional reinforcement, we're saying food isn't available to you. We give you a way to ask for that too. You can ask for it if you want to. But we find that when that is an option, because all options are available and you can choose what options you want, they very rarely actually choose food. They very often choose things that lead to exerting their agency to be able to move you in a direction or change directions or go to a place that we never expected them to want to go, down an alley that we've never seen before, or up a church stairwell to sit on the stoop for an hour and watch people go by. There are some bizarre places that dogs take us when they have the ability to, in some ways, use their proxy agency, but to open doors for themselves where we're not offering what's behind those doors. And so it's a very different experience. When we're using food, we have to acknowledge that it is our way of controlling animals. And I think in the force-free positive reinforcement side, it is very uncomfortable to realize that we are, it's our control. We're not using physical control. We're not demanding it of them. But there is still an element of you have to do this to do this. It's still very transactional. And when there are situations in which the values of a functional outcome might be just slightly less of that of food, it can lead to some very serious problems and some obstruction of understanding what an animal might want. And we see that, I think the most recognizable one among dog professionals is when fearful dogs will approach strangers to get a treat, right? They're accepting the cost of something that has more value. So what happens when we look at those contingencies and we split them apart very carefully, and we start to, from that values aligned choice making perspective, say, what if we made sure that these values were separated? If you want the treat, you stay away from the person. If you want to go near the person, you go near the person. And therefore, we really can measure your interest in that particular outcome, the value in getting closer to the person based on the choices you make, because we've made sure to clarify and separate and really dive into those things. And I think it's very uncomfortable space when people first enter it, because we use treats so much and we want to give them a treat for approaching. We want to give them a treat for this thing, but that's not listening. And that's really complicated and really uncomfortable.
It is. And I know it's not just food. I know there are dogs that, you know, would prefer a toy or whatever, but whatever the extrinsic thing is that's irrelevant to what the dog wants or needs, I think it's all kind of similar or the same. I also think this gets to why food is so often the foundation of a management system. And it's directly because the food will override whatever the animal is experiencing and get them to do what we want them to do, which is to pass the trigger calmly, or, you know, insert scenario here. And I now have kind of big issues with that. There are times, don't get me wrong, I still use management. I still need to. It's not okay for Chloe to terrorize another dog because she's having a reaction. We're going to get through that with some management. But I recognize what I'm doing. I recognize that I'm not just sort of like helping her through it. I'm actually taking control and taking something back in a way. It's necessary, sort of like a parent has to do things that are uncomfortable sometimes. But I think recognizing what we're doing with it is important, not throwing it out entirely, but recognizing that there's a problematic element to it that we just want to be cognizant of.
Absolutely. I think you summarized that perfectly. And I agree. I have a lot of cognitive dissonance around management strategies that I used to throw out so quickly. And there is a little bit of a dilemma that I think people experience behind that, because they go, well, if we can't use management right away, and you can, again, this isn't a values judgment. This isn't to say that management is a bad thing overall. It is important. It's a survival strategy and we need it. And that's fair, but it doesn't end there. The good things don't end there. And there's a lot of frustration that can be built in almost further taking your animal's agency away. And we do so with the best intentions, and that needs to be recognized as well. But there's a cost to that. The piece that I think is so interesting is how people enter this idea of adding in communication, adding in choices, and thinking it's going to take a really long time. It doesn't. We don't push quick fixes, right? But there is something so potently reinforcing about agency that when they get a glimpse of it, they onboard and generalize that so quickly that it doesn't take this repetition. It doesn't take the same things that we experience in training when we're trying to tell an animal to think or do something. Because it's coming from an internal space, we just kind of have to show and create the scaffolding that allows them to explore that. And it's in and it's there and it's ready to be used. And that can happen so fast.
Yes. I know we've been in conversations where people have said that that's a great goal. Agency is a goal, but while we get there, we need to X, Y, Z. And agency is a great goal, and we don't have to get all the way there immediately, but the basics of a framework, and then every dog's different. Every dogs take different times to do this. But my personal experience with Chloe was that we spent about 30 minutes teaching it, and we went on a walk and we used it. It was that fast. Did we use it perfectly? No. Are we still learning it? Absolutely. But have we been using it since that first 30-minute onboarding session? Yeah, it didn't take a lot to get it up and running. I think when you take the power of agency and pair it with functional reinforcement, and you have all kinds of other things going on in there, but those two things together alone are hugely, hugely incentivizing for someone, an animal, to keep using the system and to keep getting what they want and need and being able to ask for it. So yeah, it doesn't take a lot of time. And that takes us all the way back, I think, to you said in the opening about it really should be part of the antecedent, not just kind of a goal that we get toward eventually.
Absolutely. Having that ability to communicate and exercise their agency as you come into environments you're navigating together, as both learning together, you are trying to understand your dog, they're trying to understand you, going out on that first walk, it gives you a framework that allows you to use management less, but still avoid reactions. Because now all of a sudden we're getting information like, oh, we were pushing you further than you wanted to go. No wonder you reacted. When you tell me how far you're comfortable going, and I can honor that, all of a sudden, the areas of conflict where we have to manage or where we would see problem behavior reduce exponentially. So we're at a whole new baseline all the way starting from day one. So that's part of the reason that it needs to be an antecedent, is not only in it being a kindness and in getting to better understand our dogs, but in the value that gives us as far as how much work we really have to put in to training and behavior modification and where we're really starting with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have this great video of, I think it's day one or two. It's really early. And we had pulled over into a little alcove because somebody was walking toward us. And Chloe looks at me six times, like, "Mom, let's go. Let's go. Let's go." And I miss it. And I'm just like off oblivious. I think I thought she was doing engage, disengage. And I was just like, "We're not doing that anymore." No, she was clearly communicating with me and I missed it. And six times she persisted in telling me that she wanted to move forward. And there are two things that are notable about that. One is that it was like day two, where like she had the system down in terms of that start button really quickly. And the other one is that she didn't have a reaction during that time. So somebody is walking toward us. I think the person maybe even spoke to me, which is a huge deal for her. And while she's looking at me, expressing her desire to be doing something else, she is also not reacting. I can't explain that, but it was true. And I've seen it over and over again, where just the ability to communicate with me, just being able to engage in that conversation, overrides somehow the reaction. Now, she still has reactions. It happens. I'm not saying we went from zero to perfect overnight, but I've seen that more than one time, that ability to communicate, that kind of seems to prevent or override a reaction.
Certainly. We talk a lot in reactivity about there being sort of two major categories that anyone who knows me knows I hate this, but that there are the anxious reactive dogs and there are the frustrated reactive dogs. And frustration, by definition, is that inability to make progress towards or to impact your circumstances or environment. It's that outcome of that dysfunction. Or when we contrast it with our definition of agency, it is that experience of not having that ability to impact what's going on. And it makes a lot of sense that a dog is going to experience a lot of frustration when their agency is restricted. And so I don't view those things as two separate categories. I think that most, if not all, animals living in our human world alongside us experience frustration because their agency is restricted in many, many ways. And so what the intention behind introducing this as part of the antecedent is to very quickly try to piece out that bit of frustration. Is your reaction the result of not being able to access something you need to cope in this situation? Whatever that may be, we don't have to know what that is. We just need to be able to give you the tools to access it, whatever it is. That's as far as we need to go with that, or give you the tools to create a way to access it if we haven't offered that, which is a whole nother episode we can do. And in doing that, what's really interesting is not just how they ask for things we don't expect, but how they will persist in them and cope better with the triggers very quickly. There's that really interesting video. I think it was about a week, maybe just a little bit more into using this. Three triggers happen back to back. The first one, she's asking very intentionally to go up to the van. I think we talked about that in the last episode. The second trigger, you're standing in front of a church, you're on the sidewalk, busy city. She just watched and approached a guy loading his van. And she goes to sniff and a guy is walking towards you and he stops to talk to you. The same side of the sidewalk, like a couple feet from you, you can see his shadow. And Chloe stops what she's doing and she looks up at you like, let's book it. Let's get out of here, mom. And you're answering the guy, you're going through this social situation. And she kind of looks at him and she's like, yeah, nope, still want to book it. Let's get out of here. And like that piece of being able to ask to quickly move away seemed to be enough. Just knowing that that was there, even though you didn't act quickly, you didn't do it, but you did eventually do it, was enough for her to not react in that situation. And it calls into question how many times the behaviors that we see that are problematic, not just in reactivity, I see this in resource guarding, in dogs that get hyper aroused and like jump all over people or bite on people in a non-aggressive way, even aggression behaviors, anxiety behaviors, how much of those are exacerbated by this piece of frustration that could also simultaneously exist. So it's not a cure. It doesn't get rid of all the reactivity because there's certainly other elements involved. But very quickly, we see a whole new level of distress tolerance. Just it circles all back to that literature that exists.
It does. It does. And that makes me think about how empowering animals to have agency is really learner-centered, which again, coming back to human literature, we know the value of that. And in learning to respond to what Chloe needs and not just take over, like it's not about my goal. It's not about what I'm trying to do. I might really want to get us home in that moment. She might want to go another two blocks. And up front, I was very much erring on the side of honoring her choices. And now we have more of a conversation because I feel more comfortable that we're on even ground. But for a little while, it was really about centering her experience and what she needed so that I was more aware of her experience and what she needed, which is very similar to stuff we talk about in higher ed in terms of meeting someone where they are. There's an excellent development theory that's based in like a farm model where you go visit someone's farm in order to understand what their experience is. And it aligns directly with that entire concept of just meeting someone where they are, validating their experiences, and then starting to show them there are alternatives. And that makes a lot of sense to me. The other thing, not to sort of pile on here, the other thing it makes me think about is what I was really interested to learn about learned helplessness. In a nutshell, so this comes from Seligman and Meyer, that learned helplessness is the default in animals. We don't learn to be helpless. We start out feeling helpless and sort of believing that we are helpless in different situations, and we learn to enact agency. So if a dog in particular never has a chance to enact that agency, what must their lives be like? And what does happen, the explosion that must happen in their brains when they're empowered to really have a sense of agency?
Yeah, I'd love that you brought that in, because I think one of the most common things that I hear is, well, if they wanted it, they'd just do it. And that's not the case. And we know that in humans as well. It's all of us. This is a neuroscience review of the literature on learned helplessness from the original authors who coined the term learned helplessness. They are looking back at their research from multiple perspectives. It's very recent. I think it was published a year or two ago at most. And they came back and basically said, we were wrong. It is not a learned process. It is the default response to experience these aversive conditions. And we have to be taught how to navigate them, how to avoid if we want to, how to escape if we need to, before we can be self-effective. It really circles back to that idea of the choices that we offer, right? Are those enough? Are we teaching you enough of the options that we get to the thing that you value? There's a really great quote from a book that we both are currently reading that we highlight. It is Understanding and Applying Relational Frame Theory. Okay, the quote is this: behavioral variability is also key to the development of early valuing repertoires. We need to be willing and have the freedom to explore new environments and contact novel experiences in order to discover what is most meaningful. And that, in combination with that understanding of that default passivity, it was really impacted my choices around how we offer choices. Because if we're just offering you a limited scope of experiences, will you get to contact and know the things that are most meaningful to you? And what if we don't offer that opportunity? How do we do that?
Yeah, it's such a small example, but it really takes me back to the elevator thing that I mentioned. I could not have possibly understood previously that it was important to Chloe to explore the floor beyond the direct path to my apartment, but of course it is. If she has some underlying anxiety issues, obviously having a better understanding of what is around her, what's around the corner that she can't see, all of those things just come right back to that quote. That was great. I think your question too about, are we teaching enough? Like, no, not up front, you know, even once we're bought into this. But the beauty of it is that it generalizes really quickly. And for me, as a total novice owner, it was not that hard to sort of figure out ways to implement this in other contexts and start to use it in other ways. And so I just think that once we have a baseline understanding that animals, that dogs are capable of having and acting on agency, that you can't help but look for ways to give it to them and to help them enact what they have, what they want. You start understanding things like if they look, we might actually naturally understand that if they look at something, they want it. But I have started to notice Chloe looking at things in a lot more context than just say food, which is an obvious one. So is she looking at a toy? Does she want the toy? Is she looking at that bush over there? Does she want to go see the bush? There are so many different ways that they're communicating with us that we start to pick up on once we're just aware that that is communication.
Yes. And I think we've only scratched the surface of it, even in what we're describing, which is, we've definitely broadened her communication horizons in the last few months. This girl tells us a lot of things, but there's still so much that we don't know or that we haven't tapped into. And I think the more that we can approach that with wonder, and really circling back to the value that we've put in, even in the description of this podcast, is that's not possible, just doesn't factor in. If we acknowledge that it is a thing and it has to be possible in some way, the question becomes, how do we get there? And that's really what I think we need to be focusing on.
I think so too. Broadening those horizons, broadening opportunities. So this is a quote from Desnoyer and Liu in an article, Personal Agency as a Component of Applied Behavioral Analysis. It really gets to the concept of teacher-learner and how it translates to dog guardian and dog, and how this framework fits with it. So teaching and learning is not a behavior that teachers impose upon students. Rather, it is a process of supported and facilitated learning. Personal agency places an individual in the driver's seat, choosing their path and providing outlets from confining habits and routines, often controlled by situational demands or external expectations. Under operant conditions, students risk becoming passengers on a bus. Moreover, they may be headed to a destination they were denied the ability to choose. Although they may possess knowledge of the terminal goal, they may be ostensibly unaware of the many stops, wrong turns, and roads less traveled on the journey. When students are positioned to follow the lead of a GPS tool dictating where to go, when to get there, how long it will take, and when to stop, they might arrive at the destination. However, the probability that they will internalize, independently replicate, or even discover novel routes becomes limited. To counter these effects, principles of personal agency must be deeply embedded within the instructional framework.
I mean, wow. It covers so much, and it really brings us back to bringing it in from the beginning. And there's so many parallels in that to our experience as dog trainers and what we do. We may still reach that goal. We may still get obedience from animals. We may still reach that behavioral destination, but we're missing and losing a lot of very valuable skills along the way when we sacrifice agency, because it isn't sacrificing the goal in and of itself. I think that is a piece that often gets missed. We're viewing it from an obedience perspective, right? If I want you to listen to me, that's valuable. Sure, we do want that. But we don't only want that. We also want you to be capable of making good decisions and controlling your emotions and being self-effective in other things of your life. And so when we're myopically focused on obedience, we're sacrificing so many things, but it is not a problem that occurs in the reverse. Increasing agency does not sacrifice obedience. And that, I think, is a belief that is widely held and very misunderstood.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's an important point. So every time that I leave my building, there's a set of double doors and Chloe sits on the left behind the door. I poke my head out of the right and look around. That is an operant behavior that I have trained. It's automatic now. We're on autopilot about it, but that still happens every single time, that operant behavior. Or I get like a recall is a good example. We need our dogs to be able to come to us. We still have that. We don't lose that just because we have offered agency in kind of overall. There are safety things that we need to continue to do. Maybe we participate in sports, which I don't personally, but if we do, we can still be asking questions about what our dog wants or needs that maybe we haven't thought of before, and still participate in things that have that type of goal that's a little bit different than what we're talking about here in terms of behavioral modification. There's still a whole world of questions that we kind of haven't asked yet. And the reason that I like this quote and the other way that I think about it, it comes from higher ed, which there was an article that I read. It was actually as part of my application process for grad school. It's by Marcia Baxter Magolda, who was one of my professors. And it's called Good Company for the Journey. And she starts the article with this metaphor of she had been on vacation somewhere and they were going on a bike tour. And what an excellent job the tour guide did in terms of being good company for their journey and providing information, letting them make informed choices, not leaving anyone behind. Basic things that you would really want as you are experiencing something that is novel to you. And I think about that in my relationship with my dog a lot and wanting to be good company for her journey, and not just someone that is directing the journey, but that someone is participating in it with her and honoring her needs in that journey.
Absolutely. It is sitting back and being a passenger, but also an active passenger on that journey is something that is a very uncomfortable space as trainers. We want to control the journey. We want to control how you get there. And we hope that the animal will be that willing and engaged passenger. But there is such a difference between choosing to be in that role and being placed in that role. And I think it really touches on those experiences, or if we have to place you in that role, then what else can we do to make that experience mirror this that we have the luxury of experiencing and get so much more enriching information and knowledge and learning out of that experience?
Yes. And I know that we're going to talk about this another time, but I can't resist saying that that takes me right to errorlessness and how my preferences for learning may not fully align with an errorless framework. As a human, I might not want to be taught errorlessly. And as a human, I have that opportunity. I also, if I'm entering a class of some kind or even discussions about dog training, I have the opportunity to leave those discussions. I have the opportunity to change the subject. I have any number of opportunities that a dog might not have, and still I struggle with errorlessness. And again, I think it's something that people, just like with different types of reinforcement, approach with the best intentions. And it is certainly kinder than a lot of alternatives. But I think a lot of what we're talking about with agency can come into conflict with an errorless construct that's really about having only one path forward for the dog. And I understand the intent there is to kind of get to a desired result in a way that's sort of painless for the dog. But I think it does, it limits choices, and we just need to be cognizant of that.
Absolutely, it does. And yeah, this is going to be a whole nother episode, and it may surprise people to know that I have very strong feelings about ALS learning. And I will give sort of the SparkNotes version because there's a lot to dive into here, but absolutely, I think that ALS learning is incompatible with agency and choice, that it is a single track experience in which we are guiding you so that you cannot deviate from the desired task. And the desired task is arbitrated by us as the human. And in that way, it excludes the opportunity for feedback. Even if we are including the possibility of opting out, we're losing information about why. Is there a way that might be more comfortable to reach the end goal for that learner? We are guiding them on a path that we've selected as the best path for them. And there are a lot of issues with that. And we have experiences from human learning that tell us that it can be incredibly problematic. Particularly within the autistic community, there have been reports about how this procedure has greatly traumatized and impacted them because it is viewed as very restrictive. It does remove agency. And so the ways that it has been historically applied in a really traumatizing way has been to extinguish really harmless stimming behaviors for more appropriate, socially appropriate, really subjective criteria there. Alternatives. And so in doing so, even if it is not including punishment, even though it's not including, you know, aversive contingencies, there's still this arbitration of right and wrong that is happening, even if you're getting something supposedly appetitive out of it. And in that way, there is a lot to be considered about what our motivations are behind ALS learning. What are we trying to do? We're trying to make it a better experience for you so that you don't think that you're wrong and you don't think that it's bad. But there's a lot of literature that also tells us that by getting rewarded a lot for the good thing and maybe even ignoring mistakes on the back one, let's say that there's no consequence that's bad for errors, and errors we'll get into. But even in that case where we just ignore those things, there is a contrast that the learner receives about when they're not receiving the good thing, and or when they're receiving even a lesser degree of a good thing. They're able to discern that, and that does lead to some emotional impact. Instead, we should be focusing on, first of all, how we define errors, because errors involve us arbitrating that there's a right and a wrong, and that I have issues with. We also have to look at how we're handling that perspective of I'm deciding that this is the wrong thing, instead of this is feedback from you that I can use to construct a better path towards something and help you access that path. It's a very different perspective. There's an amazing review of the literature on ALS learning that we can talk about in another episode because it goes so deep. But it talks about even the use of praise in US classrooms and how that just reinforces the teacher's role as the person who delivers the rewards and who controls the access to those things, rather than being motivational or encouraging a learning process. It also shows that not engaging with errors doesn't provide the best learning outcomes long-term or the best memory of what we're trying to learn. Instead, they contrasted it with Japanese classrooms in which errors are not, you know, they're not criticized, they're not treated with shame, there isn't this arbitration of right and wrong. There's a correct and incorrect way to go about it. But they spend a lot of time discussing errors. And they discuss not just that the error is incorrect, but the thought process that got to that error and why that is plausible, but ultimately leads to the incorrect decision, and why other thought processes that may seem less possible actually led to the correct decision and what the differences in those are. And in that process, there's so much that goes into building tools and strategies that we have internally for processing information and for utilizing the skills that we're trying to learn, not just discrete knowledge, not just memorization of facts or memorization of specific movements, which I think we do a lot in dogs, but how we get to learning processes and how we're cultivating learning processes. It's really embedded in ALS learning. And I have big feelings about that.
I do too. And I cannot wait to talk about that article and all the ways that we have as individuals and as specifically in American society have really imposed a lot onto dogs and ourselves about what errors mean, what a goal is, what we value in the learning process. There is so much there and it's amazing. And it does come kind of directly out of the concept of or it directly relates to the concept of agency that we've been talking about today. Oh, so exciting.
Absolutely. There's so much. We've got so much to branch off on. But we hope anyone listening to this, if you have thoughts, please come share them with us. If you'd like to talk more about agency or the ways that we're kind of discussing these things or dive deep into these resources, join us in the Art Plus 2.0 community. We have a lot of discussions there, topics, virtual hangouts, things where we connect as a community and talk about these things as well. So please know you can join us there. Otherwise, we will definitely, it sounds like airlessness is going to be our next episode.
And definitely don't feel like you have to agree with us to come talk with us in the R Plus 2.0 community. Creative controversy is more than welcome. We are happy to have people disagree with us and challenge our thought processes and really dive into these topics. Certainly, there's much more to be learned, more to be discussed, and people from different perspectives would all be very welcome.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not set in stone on this. I think this is going to be a constant state of evolution. And if we come back in 10 years and have the same thoughts about it, I think we probably haven't been reaching out for enough perspectives or changing the ways that we're looking at this information. So it is all a process of continuing to learn. We're open to being absolutely wrong on this stuff, but to explore it in ways that we're just not quite seeing the discussion go in other areas. And we hope to be able to foster more of that discussion.
Yes, starting point here.
Exactly. Well, it was so much fun, Jen. I love this one. Can't wait for the next one.
Same. Super excited.